Sermons at Westminster Presbyterian Church, an intentionally inclusive community of faith in Worcester, Ohio.
As Boswell commentator Sandra Nakulaski points out, the second chapter of James opens with illustration that is as relevant in the contemporary church as it must have been in James's society during the first century. She says, "I dare say nearly every one of us who sits on a platform here in the front or in the choir, and the way we are positioned here at Westminster, I think all of us during worship has at some point seen a stranger entering the service late and immediately, without meaning to do so, we don't decide to do this, inferred from the stranger's manner of dress and demeanor whether they are in search of a worship experience or seeking a handout. In James's words, we have become judges with evil thoughts." And she uses the words "ouch," this verse. She continues, "Of course, a middle-class contemporary reading of this text shows some points of sharp contrast from the experience of first-century readers. While they were the very rich, like the emperor and his entourage, the rich landowners, the vast majority of folk, and almost certainly the very majority of the entire community of James's readers, were what we would consider poor. They were poor, owning no land, only a few personal possessions, and most probably spending all their income on life's daily necessities. But all right, they ought to then, you would think, identify with the destitute man who enters their congregation. He could very well be one of them, denied a few days' work by a bad harvest, injury, or just plain bad luck. Yet, instead, they cast their entire hope, an almost desperate hope, on this individual who appears to have what they lack." And it's important in this reading to realize "appears to have," because notice that the reading doesn't describe him as rich, only as sumptuously dressed. In their eagerness to curry favor with the well-off, they slight the one with whom they should be in solidarity with. To me, then, the text leaves us with the question as a contemporary readers, who do we need to be in solidarity with within our culture of today? Who are the ones that we are siding with? Because this text leaves us with the question, who are we siding with? In this story, the social distance projected between the church members and a poor visitor exposed the social situation in which we perceive ourselves. Most of us here are not the rich by our own standards. I think we all agree on that. Either as individuals or as a congregation, our legal practices are far more advanced than those in the first century, but many of us still feel oppressed and manipulated by a system. We see the middle class getting squeezed in further and further. Yet, most of us here are not the poor either. And it is very easy for us to think of the truly poor, not us middle class, but those people whom we think of the truly poor as the other. Those who are in need, with whom we are in a relationship with, strictly based on a giver and receiver relationship. James is speaking to many of us who are active then in social justice when he indicts those attitudes that holds the recipients of our ministries at arm's length. Actions that protect our privileged status as giver and fail to engage the humanity of those who receive our ministries, or who receive our works of social justice, so to speak, the ones for whom we do advocacy, we fail to see their humanity because we keep them at arm's length. To talk about the Living Wage campaign then, as students and as a people, we want to engage that issue. We want people to have a living wage, but at the same time, it's very difficult for us to bridge that gap, to truly engage a group of people and see them as truly human. Personally, I think for us as a church that desires to be a community of peace, we need to become much more aware of our inability to engage the humanity of those who receive our ministries, its help and material need, or our advocacy to change the system that causes inequity. I think that's the biggest challenge for us as a church, as we want to move forward in the 21st century, is that we lack the voices of a certain population, a certain group of people. Our judging and thus our dehumanizing of the other is so much deeper entrenched within ourselves and goes far beyond just judging the rich and the poor, especially if we look at the interplay between ethnicity, class, gender, sexuality, and ability. Just think for a minute how easily it is for us to judge people based on their appearance, but we do not know their sexual preference, for instance. Or we do not know where they come from or what they stand for. But if somebody comes through our door, especially if we have a lot of younger people from a younger generation, well, a lot of times our first instinct is to judge a person. So the question then before us is how do we keep ourselves from judging? How do we keep ourselves from breaking, or how do we break down that distance that's between us and the people we keep at arm's length? I think a good start is to exactly see this intersectionality between these different factors. This interplay is pointed out by Greta Christina in an article entitled Seven Things, and this is a dangerous article, I might get in trouble here this morning. Firstly, conservative but socially liberal people do not understand, and it's published this past week. And she points out, even if the people supporting these conservative policies don't intend this, these policies are racist, sexist, classist, ablaced, homophobic, transphobic, and otherwise socially retrograde. And she goes on and points out seven factors, including poverty, domestic violence, disenfranchisement, racist policing, drug policy and prison policy, deregulation and free trade, and I cannot go into detail of all of them. But to give you one example of what I'm talking about this morning, I would like to talk about poverty and the cycle of poverty. And I think the teacher here among us might really resonate with this. If you're poor in this country, there's about 2 in 3 chances that you're going to stay poor for at least a year. About a 2 in 3 chance that if you do pull out of poverty, you'll be poor again within 5 years. And about a 2 in 3 chance that your children are going to be poor. Among other things, she says, being poor makes it much harder to get education, job training that would help you get a higher paying job to get out of that cycle. If you do lose your job, or if you are disabled, the bureaucracy of unemployment and disability that you have to go through makes it very, very difficult for this group of people to manage the system. In fact, many of us were so concerned about the closing of Tent City and the Laurel Trailer Park. As some of you in the congregation might tell us, that there are government assistance for people to find housing and to have such shelter. But sometimes the people also deal with mental illness, And it makes it very, very difficult for this group of people to find a safe place to stay, but at the same time manage the trail, the paperwork trail, and the bureaucracy in staying in that apartment or that safe place so that they can stay there. So, and this is a place where they really need people to engage with, to befriend people who are homeless so that they can keep their safe places to stay. Also, ironically, they say being poor is very, very expensive. The effect of poverty on our children, he says, literally on the brains and their ability to function is huge. And I think our teachers can see that in our classrooms. Poverty effects on adults is appalling enough. Its effect on children, they say, is outrageous. And in case, he says, you haven't noticed, poverty, including the cycle of poverty, and the effects of poverty on children disproportionately affects African Americans, Hispanics, and other people of color. Women, transgender people, disabled people, and other marginalized groups. Therefore, I think it's important for us not only to concentrate on fiscal policy, but to see the interplay where it meets our communities and consider those other factors as we as a people say that we believe that God created us all in the image of God and that we are a whole people before God. And as these students struggle and engage that struggle, how do we engage the lower paid jobs on campus, the people doing those jobs? How do we befriend them? How do we actually go about and visit with them and together come up with solutions? So it is our challenge as a congregation to really step out of our comfort zone and to befriend people and to get to know them, not as the recipients of our good deeds, but as co-workers in creating a more compassionate and a more inclusive community. Amen.
Thank you for sharing time with Westminster. You can learn more about our community of faith on our website at wpcworcester.org.